Although we've taken a long time to get here through the year, we're going to have a run of three. So we're going to do Daniel 5, 6 and 7 over the next three Sundays. So if you want to get yourself ready for any Sunday, just read the next chapter of Daniel. In fact, next week is Daniel in the lion's den, that famous story. And then the last week we're going to look at, it's not the last chapter of Daniel, but we're going to look at the children of the kingdom in Daniel chapter 7 at the end. But as we've been following, and today we're looking at Daniel 5, which concentrates on Belshazzar's feast. And I've called this Partying as the Empire Crashes. And I think you might see some echoes in it of our own time and our own experience that we're living through. We've already said, just to recap a little bit, we've already said that this book, the book of Daniel, doesn't come in the Hebrew Bible in the section of the prophets, but it comes in the section called the writings or the scriptures. It's seen by the Jewish people more as a book for wisdom for life rather than a prophetic book. Certainly in the Christian church and certainly in the Protestant churches, we've tended to make it more a prophetic book, an apocalyptic book, but actually the Jews see it as a book about wisdom. So we've been looking at it from that perspective and that point of view. The historical situation is that the Jewish nobility had been deported from the kingdom of Judah to Babylon. The Babylon is the capital of the great Babylonian Empire, but Daniel and his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have attained high office through godly insight and their unwillingness to compromise their values and their faith in God. So actually, we see them in Babylon not as people who are ghettoizing and keeping themselves and having nothing to do with those around them, but actually they are intent on blessing and working with Babylon. And we've been seeking to take Daniel and his friends as a picture of us as the church, living in a hostile culture, living in a place that is not very friendly towards the Christian faith at the moment, but actually that our heart's desire, like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, is to bless and to build up those around us and not to attack and tear them down. Now, up until this point in the book, we've been dealing with the story of stories to do with King Nebuchadnezzar. That's Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon. And we saw last time how God intervened in his life. In fact, we've seen for a few times how God's intervened in Nebuchadnezzar's life through Daniel, particularly last time through a dream and through Nebuchadnezzar's madness and then his restoration to power and Nebuchadnezzar's recognition that God is the God of heaven and earth. But we're now coming to this place where Nebuchadnezzar has died. And we're now looking at a guy called Belshazzar. It's many years later. In fact, we can roughly date this chapter to October 539 BC. Nebuchadnezzar had died. He'd been dead for 23 years at this point. He died in 562 BC. You know, it's always difficult. I find that thing of BC. You always got to remember to count backwards. So why is this date earlier than that date and yet it's later? It's what 1066 and all that called the peculiar Roman method of counting backwards. But it's not the method of counting backwards. It's because it's the countdown to Jesus coming. So 562 BC, Nebuchadnezzar dies, and he's succeeded by his son Nabonidus. Now, you don't have to remember these names because Nabonidus wasn't very memorable. He became very unpopular with the people of Babylon, in fact, because he insisted on the worship of his own private god, Sin, who was the moon god, instead of the one that everyone else was familiar with that they called Marduk or Bel. So Nabonidus got so fed up with his unpopularity that he left Babylon and he went into Arabia for about 12 years. And he left the throne in the hands of a regent. And this regent's name was Belshazzar. So Belshazzar wasn't actually the official king. And he's only second in command of the empire, which, interestingly enough, is why in this chapter he offers the third place of power to whoever can interpret what the writing on the wall is, because he's only second in power, not first. So you think, why doesn't he make him second in power? Well, anyway, that's why. So Belshazzar's name, known to himself as Belsaruso, because it was a different language slightly, that he's the one who we're encountering in this story. Now, Daniel, I want you to get into your mind. See, we don't know how you picture Daniel. We often picture him as a youngish man, particularly in the earlier stories. But now, this time that has elapsed means that Daniel is probably now in his 70s. He is an old man. And he's also someone who has not been very active in Babylonian politics or in Babylonian rule. He's kind of been sidelined and forgotten. Also, talking historically at this point, the power of the Babylonian Empire is very much on the wane. For years, they've been a powerful and also very cruel empire. They've been rich beyond telling, because what they basically did was they raped and pillaged all of the countries around the area and sucked it all into Babylon to make Babylon this great, huge capital, this center. And not only that, but they deported people from their places into the center, into Babylon. In one sense, it's a culture not unlike the Nazism of the 1930s that sees a super race over all other races and trying to make every other race like themselves. But also very powerful in culture and art. If you go to the British Museum or if you go to some of the great museums of Europe, you'll see a lot of the Babylonian culture and architecture. So although powerful and cruel, very high in art and culture. But now they are on the wane. They've lost a lot of what they had. Their civilization is drawing to a close, and it's become very corrupt. And at this point, the Persians are on the move, coming to take them over, and they come right up to the doors of Babylon. Now, some of the histories, some of the accounts that historians give us, particularly those from the Babylonian accounts themselves, from a wonderful piece of writing called the Nabonidus Cylinder, which is actually a cylinder of clay on which is written the account of Nabonidus. It suggests that Nabonidus came back for a short while to encounter the Persians and to try and stop them finally finishing off Babylon. So Nabonidus went out, apparently, but was defeated by the Persians. So now there's nothing left between the rising Persian Empire and Babylon. Babylon is now besieged, or is about to be besieged, by the Persians. So what does now, and by the way, now it's all down, it's all on Belshazzar's shoulders. Nabonidus exited stage left, and it's now down to Belshazzar. So what does Belshazzar do? He has a party. Isn't that a good idea? The whole Babylonian Empire is about to come crashing down, and he organizes a feast. So I'm going to read through the text. Maybe you want to listen, because I'm reading from Contemporary English Version. But if you are following, it's in Daniel 5. One evening, it says, King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his highest officials, and he drank wine with them. He got drunk. And he ordered his servants to bring in the gold and silver cups his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem. Belshazzar wanted the cups so that he and all his wives and officials could drink from them. When the gold cups were brought in, everyone at the banquet drank from them and praised their idols made of gold and silver and bronze, iron, wood and stone. Suddenly, a human hand was seen writing on the plaster wall of the palace. The hand was just behind the lampstand, and the king could see it writing. He was so frightened that his face turned pale, and his knees started shaking, and his legs became weak. The king called his advisers, who claimed they could talk with the spirits of the dead and understand the meanings found in the stars, and he told them, "The man who can read this writing and tell me what it means will become the third most powerful man in my kingdom. He will wear robes of royal purple and a gold chain around his neck." All of King Belshazzar's highest officials came in, but not one of them could read the writing or tell what it meant, and they were completely puzzled. Now the king was more afraid than ever, and his face turned white as a ghost. When the queen heard the king and his officials talking, she came in and said, "Your Majesty, I hope you live forever. Don't be afraid or look so pale. In your kingdom, there is a man who has been given special powers by the holy gods. When your father Nebuchadnezzar was king, this man was known to be as smart, intelligent, and wise as the gods themselves. Your father put him in charge of all who claimed they could talk with the spirits or understand the meanings in the stars or tell about the future. He also changed the man's name from Daniel to Belteshazzar. Not only is he wise and intelligent, but he can explain dreams and riddles and solve difficult problems. Send for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. When Daniel was brought in, the king said, "So you are Daniel, one of the captives my father brought back from Judah. I was told that the gods have given you special powers and that you're intelligent and very wise. Neither my advisors nor the men who talk with the spirits of the dead could read this writing and tell me what it means. But I've been told that you can understand everything and that you can solve difficult problems. Now then, if you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will become the third most powerful man in my kingdom. You will wear royal purple robes and have a gold chain around your neck." Daniel answered, "Your Majesty, I will read the writing and tell you what it means, but you may keep your gifts or give them to someone else. Sir, the Most High God made your father a great and powerful man and brought him much honor and glory. God did such great things for him that people of all nations and races shook with fear. Your father had the power of life or death over everyone, and he could honor or ruin anyone as he chose. But when he became proud and stubborn, his glorious kingdom was taken from him. His mind became like that of an animal, and he was forced to stay away from people and live with wild donkeys. Your father ate grass like an ox and slept outside where his body was soaked with dew. He was forced to do this until he learned that the Most High God rules all kingdoms on earth and chooses their kings. King Belshazzar, you knew all of this, but you still refused to honor the Lord who rules from heaven. Instead, you turned against him and ordered the cups from his temple to be brought here so that your wives and officials could drink wine from them. You praised idols made of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, even though they can't see or hear or think. You refused to worship the God who gives you breath and controls everything you do. That's why he sent the hand to write this message on the wall. The words written there are Meneh, which means numbered, Tekel, which means weighed, and Parsin, which means divided. God has numbered the days of your kingdom and has brought it to an end. He has weighed you on his balance scales, and you fall short of what it takes to be king. So God has divided your kingdom between the Medes and the Persians. Belshazzar gave a command for Daniel to be made the third most powerful man in his kingdom, be given a purple robe and a gold chain. That same night, the king was killed. Then Darius the Mede, who was 62 years old, took over his kingdom. Powerful story. But I just want to give you some things. We're going to break into groups. What we've been doing is breaking down into groups and discussing some of these things, so you're not just listening to my voice, and thank you for your patience in listening to that long reading. We're going to do that in a moment, but I just want to bring some things that will help us as we discuss, focus in on what's going on here and how it might be relevant to us. First of all, the Jews had now been in exile for decades, and they had settled into Babylonian society, as we know. But the next ruler, the one who was about to come on the scene after Belshazzar, these Persians and Medes, we're about to change all that and give the Jews the opportunity to go back to their homeland. Now, they couldn't have known what would happen, but the change of regime would bring their hope of return to their homeland alive. Worth thinking about that. Secondly, the wealth of these Babylonians is obvious in this chapter. They're worshipping gods made of gold and silver, iron, wood, stone, probably precious stone. And they have the vessels of God there from the temple in Jerusalem, and they bring them in so that they can show how powerful they are, even in the face of approaching defeat. And thirdly, we see that Belshazzar has forgotten the lessons of his predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar, and he has belittled the God of heaven. And so God doesn't allow him to get away with it. God is not mocked. The New Testament says in Galatians, God is not mocked. What a man sows, that will he reap. And this is Belshazzar above Babylon about to reap what they're sowing. And just before we go into groups, I want to home in on the writing on the wall itself, because it's quite interesting. The words which appeared on the wall were actually quite familiar to the guests. Although they said they didn't understand the writing, the words were actually quite familiar. But there were strange words, because the three words were all sums of money. They were all units of currency, or units of weights and measures. First of all, there was a mina, and that was 50 shekels. Then tekel was actually the Aramaic way of saying the Hebrew word shekel. You probably heard shekels are the national currency. If you've been in Israel, they use shekels today as their currency. And tekel is just the Aramaic way of saying shekel. Strange thing, but that's the way they work. So a shekel, a tekel, oh, that's 11.5 grams of silver. And then thirdly, a peres. And a peres was half a mina, 25 shekels. So it's a bit like if someone wrote on the wall over there, money, money, shekels and purses. And you look at it and you think, what does that mean? Why has someone written money, money, shekels and purses on the wall? Mene, mene, tekel, ufarsin. And that's what they were puzzling over. What does this mean? But then Daniel comes, and through God's wisdom and insight, he gives the words a different meaning. Because mina comes from a word that means to account or to count. It was a counted measure of silver or gold. And so he says, God is saying to you, King Belshazzar, you've been cashed up. God has cashed you up and is making a judgment on you. And then shekel in Hebrew means to weigh, or shakal means to weigh. So he says, you have been weighed and you've been found very light on the scales. And then thirdly, this word peres just happens to also be a word that means divided and Persian. It's a very clever kind of word play that God uses in this word on the wall. So it's saying, not just saying divided, but also Persian. And so Daniel says, oh, and that means your kingdom's going to be divided, the Persians are going to get some of it, and the Medes are going to get some of it. Thank you very much. That's what it means. You can see a real divine irony here. That while Belshazzar is reveling in his ancestors' wealth and conquest, see, this isn't Belshazzar's wealth and conquests. Can you bear that in mind? Keep that. And there are some little clues here that I'm throwing out for your discussions. This isn't Belshazzar's wealth. This is his predecessor's wealth that he is using and partying with and saying, aren't I wonderful? Aren't I great? And it's interesting that God uses these monetary terms to get his attention. Ring any bells? Does this jog any memories looking over the last weeks and years in our own nation's experience and the abuse of wealth and the bringing in of crisis? For Belshazzar, this was so shocking it made his knees knock. Just one little comment before we go into groups. I was caused to think something this week that, you know, it's really interesting that morally in our society, when sexual corruption is going on, or when there are things that are sexually incorrect among our leaders and among our the higher people in society, people turn a blind eye. They say, oh, that's all right. People are allowed to do what they want. Any individual can do it. It doesn't matter. They don't have to be faithful to their wives. They don't have to be faithful to their husbands. They can have sex with whoever or whatever they want, as long as it doesn't harm anyone else. But when it comes to money, you take money, wham! Everything goes base over apex, and everyone is on your back. Isn't it interesting that we're all right, we turn blind eyes to the sexual stuff, but when it comes to money, don't you touch our taxpayers' money. Actually, it's all wrong. It's just that we've kind of put it into different categories in our society. I'll shut up at that point and let's go into groups. Now, we've got some group leaders here, and we're going to have just about 15 minutes. We're not going to have long, 15, 20 minutes, because I want to tie up at the end and also have space for prayer. So who have we got who's got a piece of paper in their hands with some questions on? Would you stand up so people can see you? There's a few folks. And if you can make your way to these folks, we might need a few more, but hopefully groups of no more than 9 or 10, I think, this morning. Can you find groups 9 or 10? And by the way, Roy, you're going to do a group with the teenage folks?